I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Tracy, Milton Bradley has been on my list for a little minute.
I think that came up when we were talking about Ouija boards, maybe.
Maybe. I haven't revisited that that outline to refresh. But he comes up periodically. He's just bumped up against a lot of stuff that I have been looking at lately. And most recently, when I was looking at inventors, his name kept popping up, even though he wasn't directly related to anything that we've talked about. And I like him because he's a good one that does not, spoiler alert, appear to have been a monster, which is always a refresher, although he certainly could get obsessed with things that other people didn't agree with. But he did contribute to a lot of fun, although he believed in very moral fun, which kind of tickles me a little bit. So I don't think it's an overreach to say that he has shaped not only the way people in the U.S. and around the globe play, but also in surprising ways, if you don't know his life story, he also shaped how a lot of us have been educated in our youngest years. And so I think that merits a little chat.
Yeah, seems like a good reason to me. Milton Bradley was born November 8th, 1836, in Vienna, Maine. The Bradleys were really not well off. Lewis Bradley, Milton's father, was a craftsman. His mother was Fanny Lyford Bradley. Milton was their only child. Lewis worked in a lot of different jobs as a farmhand, in carpentry, handyman work, odd jobs of just about any kind. In the mid-1840s, he learned how to make starch from potatoes and started a company to sell this starch. But then there was a potato blight, which ruined that plan and left the Bradley family with almost nothing. Really, all their savings had been invested in equipment for the potato processing. A lack of income led to a change of location. So when Milton was 11, the family moved to Lowell, Massachusetts, where there was mill work.
Yes, in an odd bit of happenstance, this is yet another episode where a cotton mill is featured because that is where his father worked. Milton went to Lowell School, his primary school and his high school, and he was particularly good at math and science as a student, but he was also very interested in and fairly skilled at art, specifically drawing, with no real outlet for that through the school system. So after he graduated, he got work in a draftsman's office, you know, as a very low-level office boy, essentially. And then he also sold stationery to residents of boarding houses as a side job so that he could save up some money. And the reason he was trying to sock away money is because he wanted tuition funds, because in 1854, he enrolled at Lawrence Scientific School. That school in Cambridge, Massachusetts, eventually became part of Harvard.
Bradley lived at home while he was going to school so he could stretch his savings, which was just a few hundred dollars. That meant his commute was just under 30 miles each way to and from school. This would have been a pretty arduous schedule of long days for any commuter. It was really the only way that this was going to work, though.
Following work where Lewis Bradley could find it, Milton's parents made another move, this time to Hartford, Connecticut. And that was 2 years into his college education. And this caused a little problem because Milton could not afford to move out on his own. So he had to move with his parents just 6 months shy of finishing his studies. But then at 19, Milton decided he needed to earn a living and make his own way. And so he moved not far away from there to Springfield, Massachusetts. And that is where he got his first job.
The way he got that job sounds a little unbelievable. You really could not do this today. He marched into the offices of the Wason Locomotive Car Works in Springfield and asked if they had a draftsman. The person he spoke to said that they did not. And Bradley offered himself as one and was hired on the spot at the rate of $1.25 a day. According to his diary recollection of the event, Bradley had been clear when he was asked. He didn't have any practical experience in this. And when he was questioned as to whether he could draw a locomotive, he said, "I never have, but I think I could." I feel like just show up someplace and ask for a job is like bad job advice from...
Yes.
I mean, it's ongoing bad job advice, but like, also having no experience whatsoever, it makes it a whole other level. Bradley left the office and found himself a room at a boarding house. And it probably seemed like the start of great things for him, but Wason had financial problems. And just a year into Bradley's time there, this firm closed.
I mean, to his credit, he was right. He could. He actually turned out to be a pretty good draftsman. And he had some experience in an office, just not drawing trains. Bradley was ever trying to find ways to generate income. In 1858, after the closing of the locomotive car works, he started running ads in a variety of papers in the Massachusetts area that read Bradley's Mechanical and Mathematical Institute. The subscriber, formerly draftsman for the Springfield Locomotive Works, is now prepared to give practical instruction in mechanical drawing in all its branches, viz. Detail working drawings in plans, elevations, and sections, line and brush shading, coloring, geometrical projection, linear perspective, etc., etc. Drawing instruments furnished at importers' prices. Particular attention given to working drawings of new machinery. Also to patent office drawings and specifications.
During this early phase of being in business for himself, Milton met a young woman named Vilona Eaton, and they started a courtship. But Milton knew he could not marry her unless he had money coming in, and he was really not drumming up any business at all at first. But then Wason Locomotive had a commission to start production of train cars again in 1858 from a surprising client, which was Egypt. The Alexandria and Cairo Railroad needed cars, and the plant was back up and running. Milton was contracted by Wason to draft drawings of the cars to be shipped along with the cars themselves, so the workers who unpacked them understood exactly how everything worked and should look. Bradley made a nice sum of money from this commission, and he planned to use it by purchasing equipment for his new company. He also bought a desk for his mother and a ring for Vilona.
As part of this, Bradley had developed an interest in lithographs because they had sent him a lithograph of one of his drawings of the train car, and he started to realize this was a potential business enterprise. There were not many lithograph presses around at this time. The closest one to Springfield was in Boston. That was about 90 miles away. So Bradley thought that if he could offer lithograph printing, he'd be the only one for quite a distance, and he might be able to carve out kind of a niche industry for himself. And when he reached out to an old friend from Lowell, who was named George Tapley, who will come up a lot in his life story, about buying a lithograph press from the firm that Tapley worked at in Providence, Rhode Island, Milton Bradley was invited to come and see one. He did, and he bought it, and over the course of a 2-week stay, he learned how it worked. He brought that press back to Springfield and set up his shop as a lithographer and publisher, taking down the previous sign that touted his services as a mechanical draftsman and patent solicitor. And his first commission was working on a design showcase book for a monument maker, and then soon he stayed pretty constantly busy with orders.
More bad fortune was on the way for Bradley, though, as the United States was embroiled in the growing conflict that would eventually become the Civil War. He did not have any clients lining up for the use of his printing services. But as the press sat unused, Milton Bradley brainstormed other ways to try to bring in money, and he finally came up with something that would make him a household name.
So that big turning moment in Milton Bradley's business life came when he produced a board game called The Checkered Game of Life. This game debuted in 1860, but it is unclear where the idea for it came from. So there's a booklet called The Milton Bradley Story, which is a print version of a 1973 lecture given by James J. Shea Jr., who was president of the Milton Bradley Company at the time. And in that lecture, he describes this moment this way, quote, "Milton Bradley's press stood idle and bankruptcy threatened. It was during this period that an inventor came to him with a game called The Checkered Game of Life. Mr. Bradley seized upon this opportunity and produced and sold 45,000 copies of the game the first year." So that raised my eyebrow because I was like, who is this inventor who seems to have been cut out of this whole thing? But it also seems like this account might have been based on a misunderstanding of the actual events.
In a version written by James J. Shea Sr., 13 years before his son's speech, he stated that Milton's old friend, George Tapley, had visited Bradley when the young entrepreneur was feeling dejected and stressed about money. And Tapley, who had his own problems but was overall an optimist, suggested that they play a game. And according to the older account, this evening of play of an unnamed but old English board game inspired Milton Bradley to invent a game that he could print himself on his lithograph press. Tapley, like Bradley, was out of work, but it's possible that because he had been an associate of Bradley's and had some business connections with him, this may have just been a case of sort of misspoken details.
Yeah, how Tapley maybe got characterized as another inventor in that 73 speech may have been because of that. But it does appear that Milton Bradley did not steal this idea from anyone. Coming up, we are going to talk about how that inspiration, though, wherever it came from, led to Milton Bradley very carefully and thoughtfully crafting his first game. But first, we're going to hear from the sponsors that support the show.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, You're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go Papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. Bradley worked really hard to design this first game, and he playtested it with his friend George Tapley. And then he worked very hard to actually produce it, because in addition to the printing that needed to be done to produce the board, there was also the need to package it in a way that made sense and made it attractive to prospective buyers. This was, of course, well before machinery that automated the cutting, labeling, or packing of game boxes, and what packaging machinery there was would have been way out of Milton Bradley's access. Those were all things that Bradley had to do by hand initially with one assistant to help him. And after they had assembled several hundred units of the game, which apparently took many 6-day-a-week work weeks that were 12-plus hours a day, Bradley packed all of these up and went with them to New York, planning to go store to store on cold calls, just seeing if anyone wanted to stock this new game that he had created. He asked for 50 cents per unit, but he wrote in his diary that he honestly didn't have any idea what retailers might charge for them. It was kind of like, I don't know what my invention's worth, but here's where I priced it.
Knowing a number of people who are board game developers and how much time it often takes to just like mock up one prototype of their game, not even with a box to ship it in or any of that, laborious.
Yes.
In 2 days, Milton was out of stock. Stores had been pretty enthusiastic about stocking a game that seemed like a fun way to play act through life and teach kids morality along the way, because that was the intention of Bradley's design. The game manual instructions expounded on its inherent morality. Quote, "This game represents, as indicated by the name, the checkered journey of life and is intended to present the various vices and virtues in their natural relation to each other, the whole being embodied in an attractive and entertaining amusement, well calculated to interest youth or adults. Each player, represented by his counter or man, starts in the cradle or infancy and endeavors to reach happy old age by the best course he can select, striving not gain on his journey that which shall make him the most prosperous, and to shun that which will retard him in his progress. The journey of life is governed by a combination of chance and judgment, the chance representing the circumstance in life over which we apparently have no control, but which are nevertheless governed to a great extent by the voluntary actions of our past lives. So in the game, the player oftentimes has choice of a number of moves which he can make to more or less apparent advantage. And at other times, circumstances compel him to pursue a course greatly to his disadvantage. But any such necessity can generally be traced to some false move made in the former part of the game, the effects of which could not be foreseen."
You have to live your life right, or you will lose.
You brought this on yourself, Holly.
The success of Bradley's first trip to New York gave him the confidence to finally set a date and get married to his fiancée, and he and Vilona were wed on November 8th, 1860. That was the same day that Milton turned 24, so he was still a very young man as he was doing all of this.
All of this happened alongside another event from Bradley's life that seemed like it would lead to wealth, but then hit a stumbling block. His next business venture with the press was making mass-market prints of a photograph of then-Republican presidential candidate Abraham Lincoln. This probably seemed like a surefire way to make money. Bradley seemed to think so. He printed several hundred thousand of the photos, and they probably would have been lucrative were it not for just a bad bit of luck. In the time between sitting for the photo that Milton Bradley used as the basis for the prints and the time that the election was over, Lincoln's appearance changed.
This is a little bit of a side story, but I wanted to include it because I found it so charming. The decision on Lincoln's part to grow a beard came, it seems, from an exchange that he had with a girl named Grace Bedell, who was an 11-year-old from New York. Grace wrote the candidate Lincoln a letter in which she said, quote, "I have got four brothers, and a part of them will vote for you anyway. And if you will let your whiskers grow, I will try and get the rest of them to vote for you. You would look a great deal better, for your face is so thin. All the ladies like whiskers, and they would tease their husbands to vote for you, and then you would be president." This is like sound political logic. Although the return letter that Lincoln wrote to Grace pondered whether people might think his having a beard after he did not would be a silly affectation, he did grow one in the months that followed. And then Lincoln met Grace Bedell in early 1861 when he was in New York, and he allegedly told her that he had grown his whiskers just for her. Just probably not true, but it is he did tell her that. It is probably not the reason he did it, but it is a very sweet story.
Yeah. I like the part of having an incredibly contentious and impactful election boiled down to whether he had a beard.
Yeah. Grow your whiskers.
Yeah. Once the president was headed to his inauguration, he was no longer the clean-shaven man in Bradley's souvenir photos. Bradley's remaining prints were worthless. Lincoln looked so different with a beard than he did clean-shaven that nobody wanted to buy these. He wound up destroying the stock.
You can find pictures of that original print. And it is, I mean, I think most of us at this point have probably seen pictures of Abraham Lincoln with and without beard. And he does look so very different. I could see why at the time people would be like, I don't know, is that him?
I also just, I am not a person who would buy a picture of the president.
No, me either. But, you know, they didn't have streaming services then. They had to do whatever kept their lives entertained. So Bradley had sort of put the checkered game of life aside while he focused on this souvenir Lincoln portrait project. He did get occasional orders for his board game, but though they had initially been very, very exuberantly received, it kind of slowed to a trickle. And then about the time he was feeling really anxious about money and his tanked photo plan and his lack of continued interest in his game, the gaming business started to actually pick up. But then the Civil War began, and Bradley thought it was just not the time for fun amusements. It kind of seemed in bad taste for him to be marketing a game. And early on in the conflict, he was also asked by the superintendent of the Union Army Armory to work once again as a draftsman, drawing up plans for a new rifle. And Bradley also wanted to enlist with the Union, but he was told that his skills as a draftsman were too valuable. The line that comes up in the biographies of him is this superintendent saying, "A lot of men can shoot a gun and go to war, but they can't all draw."
When Milton saw a battalion of soldiers camped in Springfield, he was, per his account, struck by the vacant looks on their faces as they stood or sat around campfires. He worried that their downtime had nothing to fill it, so they were stuck in a cycle of active conflict, training for conflict, or dread of conflict. And he got the idea that maybe his game invention would actually help the war effort. So in the hours he wasn't working on drawings for the armory, he started designing compact game kits. He knew they had to be small and light. They could not weigh down or hinder a soldier in any way. He started handing out the game kits once they were finished, and they included pasteboard versions of chess, checkers, backgammon, several different dominoes games, and the checkered game of life.
And then he also started to offer these compact game kits for sale. They were $1 per kit. He wasn't selling them to soldiers. He would sell them to stores, and they could resell them or they could donate them to the army. And charity organizations also started buying them in bulk to give out to soldiers. And soon, the order rate really skyrocketed. And this had the interesting secondary effect of also kickstarting a new level of interest in the original checkered game of life. People felt good good supporting a company that they saw as helping the Union Army, and they started to buy the full-size version of the game to play at home. This was also a way that, like, they knew that the members of their family who were engaged in combat were playing the same game they were playing. It fostered this sense of connectedness. So Milton Bradley had figured out how to reconcile his concerns over making amusements during wartime with the recognition of people actually needing such things just at those times. And he had also managed to ensure the health of his business in the process.
So this is a little bit early in the structure of the episode, but in the interest of keeping this last part of it all together, we are going to talk more about the checkered game of life and its legacy after we pause for a sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian, someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day, seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if everyone's being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource, and paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian. So we promised we would talk about the checkered game of life because we haven't described it in great detail yet. And the board for the checkered game of life is, surprise, it looks like a checkerboard, sort of. But the boxes have things printed on them. So players start at one corner of the board. It's the lower left if you're looking at the board with the printing oriented correctly for reading. And then they work their way to the top right corner. Obviously, if multiple people are playing around a board, they're not all going to have that same perspective. This game, if you've ever played the game of life as it exists today, this is far darker than its modern reimagining, which is just called the game of life. In the 1860 version, you could land on squares that were extremely dire sounding, including one that read suicide. that would end the game for you. Most of the places you could land required some sort of moral decision. So you could get points from virtuous squares, and if you rack up enough points, you win, whether or not you reach the end objective of a happy old age or not. It's not one where you get cash or anything, you only get points. And it's also, interestingly enough to me, almost impossible to win if you're playing this and you choose the path of politics.
And it seems in some ways like Milton Bradley's own life experience and often shifting fortunes informed some of the ways things could play out in this game. As explained in the rules, quote, it will be seen that poverty lies near the cradle. Now in starting life, it is not necessarily a fact that poverty will be a disadvantage. So in the game, it causes the player no loss to pass through poverty. But if in more advanced age he falls into intemperance and so thus carried to poverty, it is only by constant and renewed exertion that the lost ground can be regained. The same of disgrace. A person may in early life be in disgrace for a time through no fault of his own, but if after having had the advantages of experience he falls through idleness to disgrace, he will certainly need the helping hand of influence to give him a fat office in order to start him again in the world. This way, many ideas are suggested by the peculiar arrangement of the several squares.
Milton Bradley, of course, patented the checkered game of life, stating in his patent application, quote, be it known that I, Milton Bradley of Springfield in the county of Hampton and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, have invented a new social game. And he goes on to describe the game's workings. The player having the first move twirls the teetotum, and the number remaining uppermost when the teetotum stops indicates what his move shall be, according to the description of moves on the record dials. He accordingly enters his counter at infancy and from there makes his first move immediately. This leaves the square, called infancy, vacant for the next player to the left, who now twirls the teetotum and, entering at infancy, makes the move designated. Thus, each player in turn twirls the teetotum and moves accordingly. When a counter is moved to a square having a hand on it, directions will be found on that square carrying it to another, the position of which on the board is indicated by the index or hand pointing to it. Thus, a counter can never stop on a square having a hand on it. The account of the game is very conveniently kept on the record dial by the rotary brass pointer. Thus, when a player moves onto a square containing 5, turn the pointer to 5, and if onto another containing 10, to 15, and so on. Any player who reaches happy old age gains 50, which is added to his amount. But as the winner must gain 100, the game is not concluded until someone has obtained that amount. As happy old age is surrounded by many difficulties, 50 may oftentimes be gained as soon by a succession of smaller numbers as by striving for happy old age. And again, he summed up with that line that we mentioned earlier, which I love enough that I thought it bears repeating. The journey of life is governed by a combination of chance and judgment.
But though he didn't credit anyone else in the patents, the game wasn't entirely original. It might be better to say it was a new version of a game type that had been around for hundreds of years. Spiral race games, that's games in which players progress along a spiral path on a board as they race to complete the goal, have been around for a really long time. According to a New Yorker article by Jill Lepore, written in 2007, the oldest spiral game might be an Arabic one called the hyena game. In it, pebbles represent the player's mothers, and they have to follow a spiral track to a central point where a task is completed and then return home before they become victims of a hyena.
That sounds kind of like a fun game. That one, it sounds like, is like not a... Obviously, it is old enough that it is not necessarily on a printed game board, but it's one where you can draw a spiral in the sand and then use that as your game board. In 1790, a board game appeared in London shops that was called The New Game of Human Life. And this was a map board that advanced players from being an infant to status as immortal by taking them along life's journey with possible pitfalls of temptation and options to choose virtuous acts. So that sounds quite familiar. In less than a decade, the new game of human life had spread to North America, and it was suggested to parents on both sides of the Atlantic as a good way to teach children about morality. And this was followed by other similar English games, the Mansion of Bliss and the Mansion of Happiness being two primary ones. Both of those games end with a winner getting into heaven. The Mansion of Happiness was pretty popular in the U.S. in the first half and early middle of the 19th century, so not long at all before Milton Bradley's version popped up. Whether or not he was familiar with these other specific games is unclear, but here's what I love. If he did know about them, what's really interesting is the way that he shifted the theming of the game from their approach. So the Mansion of Happiness is very obviously a game about Christian morality. The goal is to secure a place in heaven through gameplay. But in Bradley's version, although the morality of it is very similar, and it's very much about doing what's right, the theming is secular. If you live a good life, you will get to happy old age instead of any kind of religious immortality goal.
As Bradley had steered his company through the Civil War years, he'd also hired other people to run the lithograph press, so his time was freed up to work on other projects while the checkered game of life kept a steady stream of revenue coming in. This resulted in a lot more games. One of his most popular was a croquet set that was small enough to be set up on a tabletop. This came out just as the U.S. was embracing croquet, so unlike some of his earlier ventures, the timing was just right.
Yeah, there are some people who credit him with popularizing croquet. I found ads for his croquet set as early as 1866, and somewhere between 1866 and 1868 is kind of designated as the time that the U.S. got really excited about croquet. So certainly he may have been part of making it available to everyone. On a sadder note, in 1866, Milton's wife, Vilona, hosted a birthday party for her husband. And while that party was going on, he noticed that she was less energetic than usual. And she continued to have less of her usual spirit over the next couple of weeks, and Milton became concerned and had a doctor come to the house. And Vilona was deemed just to need rest and, you know, to drink tonics. And she took it very easy, but her symptoms got worse and she died on March 13th of 1867. They did not have kids and Milton did not want to live alone. So he asked his parents to move in with him after Vilona's passing, which they did. His father actually started working with him at the company. And during this time, he threw himself into work and developed a great number of things, including a zoetrope.
In August 1868, Milton met a young woman named Ellen Thayer, who went by Nellie, through his friend George and George's wife, Mary Elizabeth. In the year and a half since Vilona's death, Milton had seemed to avoid the company of women entirely. But when he met Nellie, they talked late into the night. He really adored her, and so did his parents, and they were engaged just a few months later. They married the following spring on May 21st, 1869. They had two daughters, Florence and Lillian Alice.
In 1869, as the newlywed Bradley was several years into what had become a successful business, he went to a talk given by educator and transcendentalist Emily Palmer Peabody. And in this talk, Peabody, who today is known primarily as the person who opened the first English language kindergarten in the U.S., talked about early childhood education and the work of German education reformer Friedrich Froebel. And Milton Bradley was a very receptive listener to all of this, and he found the ideas advocated by Froebel and in turn Peabody for children to learn through activity and play just very inspiring.
Two actions on Bradley's part came out of this experience. One, he offered to publish a book that outlined all these educational ideas. Two, he decided that his company would manufacture and provide as gifts educational materials that would supplement classrooms that used the educational concepts of play. This was a really important development in education in the United States because the idea of an early educational classroom filled with brightly colored toys was just not something that really existed. So working with educators, Milton Bradley helped usher in the popularity of kindergarten. This was an unpopular endeavor with a lot of Bradley's business partners. The company was not experiencing the same robust sales that it once had. Their margins were really thin. Their president was doing research and development on educational materials instead of new social games. In 1878, two of his partners left, and George Tapley bought out their interests. Bradley is said to have continued good relationships with everyone involved, even though they did not share his vision regarding the importance of early education.
From 1869 on, Bradley was focused almost exclusively on inventing and patenting educational tools. He made crayons and school-grade watercolor sets and construction paper packets. So a lot of the things that many of us associate with the playful and artistic parts of our childhood classroom experiences were shaped in part by Milton Bradley's determination to give the kindergarten movement solid footing in the United States. He invented a kindergarten table in the 1880s, and one of Milton Bradley's designers, Cornelius Hastings, was responsible for the invention of the one-armed paper cutter that is so often used in classrooms and now in crafting and other places, but I have such memories of it in my elementary school classrooms, those big, giant, heavy, oh, I love those things.
They're very satisfying. Also, a little scary sometimes.
Yes, I don't know that they're great for kindergartners, but they're they're certainly efficient at cutting big chunks of paper. One of the gift items that Bradley had made for Elizabeth Peabody's effort was a set of blocks. So normally, these kinds of blocks would just be bright, solid colors to encourage imaginative play. But Milton had decided to put letters on the blocks. And this was something that Elizabeth Peabody was apparently really angry about. And they were very good friends, but they got into quite a big fight about it because she thought that was directing the kids too much. But Bradley made the blocks, so he got his way. And now we think of blocks with letters on them as very standard from an early age. And the thing was, as he was developing gifts for Peabody, he also started offering them at retail. And soon, other companies were also trying to get into the market of learning toys and school supplies. And to retain his standing in the school market, Bradley acquired the Kindergarten News in 1893, and he started publishing it directly through the company.
In 1907, Milton Bradley, having run the Milton Bradley Company for 47 years, retired. He let the younger executives take the reins. Milton Bradley died in May of 1911 after a very brief and sudden illness.
Yeah, it was one of those things in one biography I read. It sounded like he went for a car ride with his wife. They had a great time. The next day, he didn't feel good. And something like 48 hours later, he had passed. It was very, very quick. In 1960, the Milton Bradley Company celebrated its 100-year anniversary by developing a modernized version of the checkered game of life. And this one is probably much more familiar to anyone listening. It is the game of life, and it shifted to use that spiral path method that we're all familiar with now. But unlike the 1860 version, which focused so much on morality, the mid-20th century life was about financial prosperity.
The Milton Bradley Company was acquired by Hasbro in 1992. Many Milton Bradley games continue to be produced, including classics like Candyland, Axis and Allies, Battleship, Connect Four, Operation, and Twister.
In 2007, the Game of Life Twists and Turns was introduced, and that offered players a much more flexible approach to play. It was not so much about a goal, but racking up points and money. In 2010, the Game of Life was inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Oh, the Game of Life.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about on Friday. And I will make confessions that make me sound like a monster.
Okay.
So I have listener mail. This is one of those listener mails. This one has everything. It is from our listener, Sheila, who writes, "Hi, I discovered your podcast last year and I've been hooked ever since. I shared it with my husband and now Stuff You Missed in History Class is the only podcast my husband listens to. I am an artist and I absolutely love when your podcasts relate to art history. Don't be shy sharing that art." Sheila also makes a suggestion for a podcast topic, which is somebody I would like to talk about, and also mentions that they're having a hard time figuring out how to search episodes. This is a problem we have run into for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have a more searchable situation. I think our usual advice, if you do a search just online, not on any of our players, for Stuff You Missed in History Class and a subject, you're more than likely to find it versus trying to look through a player and search, which I always have trouble with.
I would say even that is less.
It's not as accurate as it used to be.
Yeah. And that is, I use Google as my search engine And that is changes to the Google algorithm, not anything that's really within our control, I don't think. But yeah, some of the individual podcast apps, various ones, are kind of searchable by episodes. Ours, the iHeart radio app, not really searchable by episode.
Yeah, it's kind of it's a little bit tricky. So apologies. There's not a ton we can do about it, but we hear you and feel you. And then here's the important part, photos.
Yeah.
Sheila sent a lot of good photos. The two parakeets are Ren and Stimpy, which is adorable. And also like appeals to my love of animation. We adopted them, Sheila says, from a bird rescue. And then another dog of my dreams. Here is our Akita Emma with Santa. I love Akitas so desperately. I can't even. If you don't know what an Akita is, it's a big Japanese, gorgeous, fluffy dog. And I love them.
Yay.
Emma was adopted from a shelter last year, and she is, according to Sheila, a gentle giant. And then finally, the one who rules it all, they're Tortie Jazzy. And Sheila, because she is an artist, also shared one of her watercolor and ink paintings. It is of a bird, and it is beautiful. So this hits all of my stuff. We got dogs, we got birds, we got art. Sheila, thank you. What a delight. And that Akita is with Santa, who we also love. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And this Tortie has what I call Tortie face.
No.
She will sass you, I can tell. Mm-hmm. she will tell you how to do the dishes, how to dress, and how to touch her very specifically, and how much to feed her every day. Listen, I know I love a Tortie. Thank you so much, Sheila. This was such a delightful email and so full of visual wonders that made me smile over and over and over. So I really appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your art with me. It's so beautiful. I love it. I love birds, so we're all good. If you would like to write to us and share a million pictures of things that will make us grin, or just to talk about something on the show, or pictures that maybe won't make us grin but are important, you can do that at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And if you have not subscribed, you can do that on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.